Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today, I speak with Dr. Tracy Seidsinger, who is a psychoanalytic psychologist currently practicing virtually from Brooklyn and upstate New York, with a focus on gender and sexuality, maternal mental health, spirituality, and the arts. Her writing can be found in Studies in Gender and Sexuality, Public Seminar, and Routledge. She is currently working on a collection of essays bridging psychoanalytic insight, interviews, and memoir to bear on the topic of feminine knowing. She serves on the board of directors for the Museum of Motherhood as artist residency coordinator and is currently engaged in research on support structures outside of the nuclear family. She is passionately involved in the community psychoanalysis movement, which makes psychological care accessible to all as a matter of social justice and equity. Today we discuss several topics, including the use of the analyst subjectivity and use of the self as an instrument in therapy. We also discuss community psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, the importance of process in the work we do, and how process can be illuminated in consultation, supervision, and peer groups. Lastly, we discuss Dr. Seidsinger's creation of her community clinic, which I'm so excited for you to hear about. We hope you enjoy the episode. Dr. Seidsinger, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you today.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. To get us started, we'd like to share a little bit about yourself, maybe share parts of your personal and professional identities that might be important for our listeners to know about.
Sure. Well, right now I am practicing, of course, virtually, as most people are in New York State and upstate and in Brooklyn. And I am in the process of opening a nonprofit psychotherapy clinic, expanding beyond the private practice world that I'm mostly in right now. And I'll just say briefly that my main backgrounds analytically have been of a Jungian orientation and a relational orientation. And I can talk a bit more about that later. That's where I am right now.
Great. So tell me a little bit about your journey into psychoanalytic psychotherapy. How did that start for you?
Yeah. Well, I think, as you know, you talk about, as many people talk about, psychoanalysis is pretty hard to find even within graduate institutions. And I was lucky enough that I had in my graduate training, which was at Fuller Seminary in California, it was not on most of the radar for sure, but I did have one professor who led me to Jung, sort of saw my own interests in my work with spiritual exemplars and religious experiences, and a lot of imaginal work kind of led me. They saw, they weren't particularly Jungian themselves, but they were helpful enough to realize that that's the direction that I was going. We did some independent studies, and that was a little bit of my dissertation work. But really, you know, I think, as is common also in grad work, even going to therapy wasn't required for my training. Certainly going to analysis was unheard of as required for training. And I think when you go to analysis is when you really encounter psychoanalytic work. Or when you, at least when that part of you opens up. And so I knew that that was a path I had been set on, you know, actually, I come from a pretty religious background. That's not a strong part of my identification now or my practice now, except that I do see a lot of people who are working around issues of spirituality, either you know, their own longings and how those searches for meaning fit into soulful work. And oftentimes a lot of trauma that's religious based too, you know, runs the whole gamut. But those are two of probably the most common things that show up as I see it now. But in any case, I have that religious background that was a big part of my focus in those early years of work. And Catholicism started sort of calling to me outside of my, I wasn't raised Catholic, but in the midst of learning very kind of a general approach to clinical psychology, there was this other thread in my life of Catholicism having a very strong pull, especially from other countries and the spiritual archetypal aspects of it. And so I worked with people who were nominated as religious exemplars in that early time in my career, but then went on after that was over and I was on internship, found my way into Jungian analysis. And that was the beginning of that journey. And I'll just say a little bit about studying within a Jungian institute, that, you know, it's often Jung is the stepchild of Freud. I think it's there's a lot more open dialogue now, which is really great, because one of the things that I think is so important for those of us who work in the unconscious is to realize that the unconscious is bigger than we in our egos think it is, and to expand who we connect with and expand our theories. And that's a lot of what New York has offered to me is the expansiveness of, while working in a Jungian institute, to meet people of a lot of other orientations. But there's, you know, great appreciation for the symbolic and for the perspective aspects of the symptoms and the being able to look forward in a soulful way with whatever is going on. But at the same time, that also led me into relational psychoanalysis, which is very much focused on the dyad, and the here and now of what comes out in the symbol in the dyad. And I think that those two have really worked together, even if they're unconventional combinations.
This leads me to the idea of the analyst as part of the dyad, rather than just an observer or just someone who makes interpretations. Can you tell us a little bit about the analyst subjectivity and the use of the analyst self in the therapy or in the analysis?
Yes, and that's something that we think about a lot. And actually, when I was thinking about what we would talk about and how I might introduce myself today, I was really, especially because you're going off onto internship, I was thinking about the fact that when I was on my internship is when I became pregnant with my first child, and I have three kids and I'm a divorced mom alongside my analytic practice. And I think that Those are things I don't mind sharing, and often they will always be tied together in who I am and how I practice and how I see what it means to practice. First of all, you know, at that time, both of those things meant a certain amount of sacrifice, a mentality of sacrifice. And I think that especially as women, that's something that I've seen over and over again in what it means to be a therapist, what it means even to be an analyst and to have a maternal function, is often really culturally conscripted as doing what other people want you to do. and being the one who absorbs and accepts and absolves all of that. And unfortunately, I was absolutely conscripted into both of those mentalities and both of those roles. But one of the things you also asked me about before this was learning. And there's, you know, there's a lot I've been learning, so I can speak to other things too. But I think at, you know, I've also had the benefit of enough experience to realize that is absolutely not what it means to be a woman, a feminist psychoanalyst, a mother, and including what it means to have the subjectivity of the analyst in, and the recognition of two subjectivities in a dyad. Especially when we recognize two subjectivities in a dyad, because it means that we are our best instruments, you know, and not everyone uses their intuition, their feeling, their intellect equally, right? We have different ways of using those things, but I do know that for some of us, we ourselves, our subjectivity, our intuition, our affect are our best instruments. And that also means that what things we are limited in, where the treatment has its limits, what we're not okay with, what we need to open up, what hits us in a way that is terrifying, and yet our minds return to it. And so even though it feels initially like a limit, it's something that says, yes, go there, you have to go there. Those are also aspects of the subjectivity in the treatment that I found to be both in Jungian work and in relational work. It doesn't matter sort of who you name it, what you call it, that the personal is the way forward.
Started thinking about a talk I was at yesterday, actually, at the Division 39 conference, and it was about the analyst's beauty, specifically with women having male, female, or whoever else as the analyst. Mm-hmm. And as analysts, you can interpret someone's pregnancy. You can, you know, you can visibly see the baby, you know, in the belly. And the thing that we don't often think about is the beauty of the analyst. And how that's affecting the transference. And something that really came up for me is we don't often talk about the beauty, and they're using beauty quite broadly here, not necessarily someone's, you know, appearance, but beauty. And I thought it was really powerful because the talk was specifically on countertransference reactions that were never addressed with the patient. And she went couple of years without actually talking about it, and there was a lot of rage and anger by the patient. And as you were talking about that, I'm becoming more aware at just how important the subjectivity of the analyst is or the therapist. And I think women in general oftentimes don't address some of the reactions that they're having in the treatment,
mm-hmm.
beyond maybe being, you know, pregnant, or beyond the ring on your finger.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you mean about the beauty, like how you said a little bit about how that's being defined, but could you say more?
Yeah. So beauty, they didn't talk a whole lot about it, but essentially beauty, they took the perspective of beauty being in the eye of the beholder. So beauty mm-hmm. can look a lot of different ways for the patient. And if that's not explored, I think mm-hmm. it's foreclosing on that opportunity. To explore beauty, sexual desire in general, and it just really forecloses on an opportunity for the treatment.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of thoughts about that, but the first is that it does place the dyad in a larger social context of sort of how I would imagine something in that is about how are you perceived by others versus how am I perceived by others, and opens up something about envy. And and again, even the dyad is a microcosm, but it's within another context, multiple other contexts too. Mm-hmm. But that really makes me think about the capacity for symbolic thought, which is really the heart of analytic work, right? Is to have a space where no matter what is there, is able to be thought, is able to be spoken, and in that way held in a space without being acted on. And so much more can open up within those confines. However, I think that we have a really, really difficult cultural problem around expectations of beauty and expectations of woman that is so often collapsed into something that's really concrete. And, you know, one of the ideas that I'm working on right now is, to what extent is pornography an other or a transitional object? Because as you know, as one of my mentors is, you know, often saying that you can, you know, people have any of the sexuality they want. That's fine. You know, it comes in many, many, many forms. But what people do with their sexuality to one another, that's something that we take issue with, and that we work in, because it is tied to aggression. It can be used against others in a dominating way, and many other ways, of course. But domination and aggression are, I think, really interestingly linked to symbolic thought and the not having symbolic thought. And I mean, I you know, have to mention in a timely way the shooting attacks on Asian women that happened last week, and that there's so much, I think, in the current awareness that we probably often have, but this is a real tragedy of the lack of symbolic thought and the tolerance for the lack of symbolic thought in popular American culture. So my mind definitely goes there in something that's really a key aspect of our work. And I think as women identifying analysts, that this is a particular place of action and of bringing subjectivity and bringing felt limits and spoken experience into the room. Not only experience, felt experience, but also, you know, the perspectives that we have come to oftentimes through experience in sometimes a more forceful way than male analysts might need to, because there is that other, that third of culture outside too, that is very much in the dyad.
You mentioned the idea in the document that we had about the idea of transparency and talking about the process that's happening. And I'm thinking about that now as you're starting to talk about maybe having to be a little bit more forceful. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about transparency within the process that's happening in the room.
Yes. Another thing that I carry with me that another mentor has taught me, and I think is very true, is that the most important place to understand and to dig into the work that you're doing is with the person you're doing it with. And I mean, that may seem very obvious, right? But I think in actuality is not at all obvious, and it's not the way that a lot of us find ourselves practicing, because we know we're always working with some amount of resistance, hopefully, because that's where the work is. And resistance means that if sometimes I say green, you say red, and you can't just keep saying it stronger in order for it to be true. And so oftentimes, I mean, we need consultation groups. We need our readings. We need to write things that are outside of the work. Absolutely. That is the most generative space in having personal thought and autonomy and separateness in the work. And because of that, in addition to that, then the work in the dyad can go further than you think it can most of the time. That if you're feeling something that doesn't make sense, if you've forgotten or you seem to have forgotten something that, you know, this patient is sure that you know, or if you're feeling uncomfortable, if they're asking you to do something, you know, to do something in a session or to be able to talk about something or show you something that really does not sit with you, then those things can be spoken about. And that's, you know, for example, I mean, this is why I sometimes hesitate to say exactly, but again, in the instance of transparency, it helps to have examples, but it's different for everyone. But, you know, people can ask you to go to events outside of sessions that are really meaningful to them. And sometimes you might say yes, but where does it register? And there's always, this is what analysis is there's much talking and there's much consideration before you ever act. And if there's a feeling that actually I have to be with my children at that time, or I'm really confused right now. I don't seem to remember this thing that you're talking about. And, you know, I don't know if it's because you think you told me or you didn't tell me, or if it's because this is really something that's hard for us to hold. It's something sometimes as simple as that. Sometimes it's much more drastic than that. But to bring your experience and not be ashamed of it, right? That's one of the ways that transparency shows up in the work. Mm-hmm. I seem to have forgotten some of the, speaking of forgetting, I think I forgot part of the original thread of what you asked me and where we were going.
No, I think you answered it. I was wanting to really illuminate or highlight the idea of transparency within the process. Mm. And I think you did that, the idea of really seeing where something is sitting within your body and reflecting on it before answering, for example, or really working through it with the patient. And I think that's really beautiful. It's often something that doesn't happen, at least in our training. I can't really speak to psychoanalytic work necessarily because I'm not there yet, but yeah. I will say it doesn't often happen within our work in graduate school.
You know what, early
on.
Yes. And that is why I first thought about talking about that with you, because I've noticed that just the nature of having these podcasts is very, it feels very much in process to me. Mm-hmm. And I applaud you for your willingness to do that and your courage to do that, which, and not courage because it's a thing that should be difficult, but I know it is difficult, and that you, when you're in process, you don't know where you're going. And it's a beautiful thing because you're actually able to be affected by the process. But especially in our field, we protect ourselves to the detriment of finding out where we could go. You know, we read papers, which are lovely. I love to read papers. It helps you to clarify your thought. But at the same time, as you clarify your thought, then you foreclose on other thought. And we really have to do work in figuring out what is needed at what time. You know, there's fluidity in the process, and there is stability and constancy also. And both are called for. So I think the transparency of being someone who is in process is also something that I advocate in personal life. It's not, you know, I think more people are talking about this now, that having a vibrant personal life is really essential to the work, and not having to sometimes hide behind the stories of other people, as if no one could possibly know about your personal life. And you're, again, back in that position of being the one who absorbs others. That's not the work, to my mind. And so I'm another thing that I'm writing right now is a memoiristic collection of essays. I think that's something that's frightening, because I realize a lot about myself, all of the different characters within my own being, not all of them, I'm certain, but many of them are becoming more known to me, and sharing that in a more public way. But I think that if we, in the profession have more transparency in our personal lives, we also have more containment in our work, because we need both of those things.
You were alluding to consultation just a while ago, and I'm thinking now about this idea of having a vibrant personal life and also a vibrant life within consultation. This idea of honesty and transparency within consultation, mm-hmm. and supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little bit about the importance of mentorship, consultation, even supervision within the work that we do?
Yeah. As I mentioned to you, I'm in the process of starting a clinic, an unconventional clinic, I would say, that is really geared at serving people across the spectrum, whatever spectrum you're talking about, low income individuals, Medicaid, Medicare, as well as people who are able to pay for themselves, and having them come together, having a diversity of clinicians, really bringing in lots of different theories of the unconscious, as well as experiences of personal backgrounds, and that when you bring difference together is the most fertile space, if we can tolerate one another. I'd like to talk more about that, but just in the sense that one of the unconventional, perhaps, aspects of the clinic that we're forming, along with my partner who you spoke with before, my business partner, Carlos Padron, is having a place that is intentional about how clinicians exist together, and not so much training focused, but being in a space together in a committed way, and in a non-hierarchical way of respect that so often is lacking, I think, in private practice, where we're pretty excluded from each other. Just to be in a physical space does go a long way. But in addition to that, having intention around how we hold each other. So, I continue to participate in consultation groups and lead consultation groups, both because it is so essential to the work to have these holding environments. So much of what we do is hold the stories and hold the secrets and hold the hopes of our patients, which is a tremendous honor. And it's a tremendous weight. And we are always coming from our own limitation. Part of what that means is that we need others to see those stories sometimes in different ways and to help us, especially when we get stuck. And part of that stuckness can be an over-identification, but to see different perspectives in how are really important in holding our cases together. I think that's probably all I can say. The most important thing is to have those spaces, though, of course, in addition to that, is to have those spaces where you are safe because, I mean, if we take the clinical work that we do as sacred, which I do, as a sacred honor of being present to the unfolding of a person's soulful story and existence, where that involves symptoms, of course, but symptoms toward some other deeper form of being, that's sacred work. Mm-hmm. And if we take it as such, then who we share those stories with is also very sacred and very important. Not only to trust them to hold the stories too, because we have to, but the relational work, if it's already present in the dyad between the analyst and the patient, then the relational work is absolutely present in any consultation that we do. And being able to talk in those groups, not as a form of therapy or analysis itself, but to see where the countertransference is happening, what are the particular zones that this dyad goes to that's different than if it was a different dyad. Same patient, different dyad we're talking about. What are the zones you're in? And to be able to, you know, sometimes in groups that I've been in, we talk about deeply personal things. Because of course, those are the deeply personal places that we're going with our patients. And it's not only analytic, like personal therapy work. They're not divorced from each other. And so to be able to be cultivating those spaces, first of all, is important, to have consultation groups. And beyond that, to have groups that you can trust to hold each other's personal stories as part of the work, I think is very important for everyone who's practicing.
I'm thinking about what happens when we do consultation or when we do supervision. I think oftentimes, I will say at the beginning of my training, I certainly did this. I positioned myself as someone of knowing, someone who knows. Mm-hmm. I did that, I think, out of my own insecurity, but being in a position of unknowing, I think, is where the work needs to go for me, and I think it needs to go for a lot of people. You know, at the beginning of my training, I didn't know it. I mean, I was pretty insecure. I didn't really know what I was doing.
Of course. And, how could you get into training?
Right. And as a defense, I think I put myself in a position of knowing. I think mm-hmm. I imagine that happens with a lot of people. But the idea of consultation, I think that really pushes against that, pushes mm-hmm. against the therapist as someone of knowing. Mm-hmm. And puts the person in a position of not knowing.
No, I mean, this is the thing, is just because you don't know doesn't mean you don't know.
Right, right.
And the word unknowing is part of revealing that truth. That, and again, it is absolutely implicit. It is contained in our theory that we don't know. In theories of the unconscious, anyone you look at, if you're talking about psychoanalysis, I think if you're talking about ego psychology and a lot of what modern clinical work has become in America, that's a different story. But certainly within psychoanalysis, there has to be not only allowances for not knowing, but an appreciation of the not knowing. Yes. That, and I think that if we can begin to change our attitudes about what questions mean, about what unknowing means, mm-hmm. And to see that it doesn't mean you don't know what's going on. You don't also have a theory or guiding principles or even, you know, a very good case write-up of what you're doing. Oftentimes you absolutely have those things. And because you have those things, you're able to also see what you don't know and what the patient doesn't know. And then you're in the work.
Yeah, I mean, you cannot fully encapsulate what's happening in the treatment. It's just impossible to do. And just what I really appreciate about consultation and supervision is being confronted with what goes beyond what you know. Mm-hmm. I just
I don't know if I'm fully making sense here, but the very idea of consultation is so enlivening to me, the idea of it. Mm-hmm. I'm really appreciative for the spaces that are provided for me, whether it's through the podcast in some in some way, but also within my training too. I really appreciate those spaces and the safety that those spaces provide.
Yeah. You know, I'm associating to it now. I'm not sure why, but one of the things that I had thought of speaking about here is that very early in my career, I had a short, on one of my externships, an encounter with another mentor, I would say, although I didn't work with him very much. He was not my point person at that site. But this was in a trauma clinic. And he said something I never forget, which is that people will tell you things that you can't possibly imagine are true. And most of the time they are true. And in that context, it meant really horrible things that I understood I didn't want to believe are true. No one wants to believe are true. And the thing that we do, of course, is to just tell ourselves it's not true because we have had the privilege of not experiencing them. Or sometimes we have and we wish we hadn't. And I, you know, I've seen how over lots of other contexts, the same thing is true. And we are not believing that what our patients are telling us is true is almost always a sign of our own defense and our own need to really go to the places that they're asking us to go.
That's really beautiful. I haven't thought about truth in that way, mm-hmm. kind of our own subjective truth, and how that isn't quite congruent with other people's truths.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that a little bit more, especially with working with trauma. Laura and I, the other part of the dyad.
You miss her today.
Yes. She's unfortunately not able to be here, but I've been thinking a lot about truth lately. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and you're right to call it subjective truth. I think it's interesting because in that trauma context, it came up in terms of objective truth, which is, we have to do a lot of work around this too, right? Of where, at what level do we believe a person? Because it is a sneaky way of continuing to be defensive to say, I believe this is your subjective truth, but I don't believe that happened to you in objective reality. And the mind takes things inside and does its own work that is internal and it is very much the heart of analytic process, but it's again not divorced from objective reality. And I think that we have to take what our patients say on some level as objective truth and be willing to consider that sometimes terrifying, disgusting, horrifying things are more true than we wish that they were. And to actually contend with, you know, any fantasy of the mind is also related to reality.
This conversation has taken us a lot of different places and we're just about out of time. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about your hopes for where you want to go next. So you talked a little bit about the clinic. I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about your hopes for the future or what you really plan on doing next.
Yeah, thank you for bringing us there. As I mentioned, I'm in the beginning stages of starting this clinic, and there are so many other versions of myself and as a clinician that I don't know yet because this clinic already has a life of its own and it doesn't have a physical home yet. And there are so many other versions of what it will become because there is there's a life around it, and there is a life around community psychoanalysis, and I am so excited for this. And so anyone who wants to talk about it can get in touch with me, because I think, again, in terms of transparency and consultation and being in process, we grow together. But I will say specifically that this is going to be a Brooklyn-based clinic. You know, a lot of the work in New York is Manhattan-based, and we need a lot more presence in the outer boroughs, and especially in terms of serving low and middle income individuals, minorities, and being able to provide culturally competent care with clinicians who are truly diverse. And that's very exciting to me, because there's no doubt that there is a need for this, but that, you know, in my private practice and working, again, as a parent, it's not been my path to be really working within institutions at the same time as giving the kind of care that, you know, just made sense for me. And that's one of the things that led me into private practice, for better and for worse, right? It's not only isolating, but it's also really a product of the capitalist machine. And I think, you know, so many of my colleagues experience the same thing, that no matter how much we do to have sliding scale fees, to see those who can't afford what is, you know, even a Medicare reimbursed rate, and to be equitable in that, who's even picking up the phone to say, maybe this therapist would see me for a fee that I can pay, or has the resources to know to do that, or to come into the city. And there are so many ways in which private practice isn't, no matter how much we end up sacrificing of ourselves, which it does become a sacrifice, that it's not, it doesn't situate itself to be equitable, because then, of course, we also have to provide for our own families and pay our own student debts. And so there's a real problem with trying to intercept the capitalist system by saying sort of like, I can catch all of the problems and absorb them into myself so that those who are behind me don't have to catch it, which I think we would love to do. But it doesn't work. And so I'm really hopeful that in this clinic model that we're devising, there's a way of having community of therapists and analysts, really taking care of our community of analysts, because we have to do that before we do anything else. We have to have freedom of thought and open communication, and know that we're, you know, our bodies are safe, we have health benefits, we have stability in our income, that we can provide these things for each other, and we can trust each other in order to provide that kind of context for our patients. And so that's absolutely what we want to do for our patients, is to have a community-based clinic that people can come to for, you know, obviously for treatment, for intensive treatment, oftentimes, and again, bringing back the model of psychoanalytic treatment for all populations when there is a psychic need for it, whether that's being close to breakdown or, you know, oftentimes it shows up in being close to breakdown or other symptoms, that there's often a great need for intensive, deep psychic work and psychoanalytic treatment. So to have that as the primary focus, of course, but within a physical structure that also has a community of, you know, spaces to come for other talks and for art exhibits and for however the community wants to use the space. That's a part of it. So those are some of our beginnings, and I'm very excited about it.
That sounds wonderful. Laura and I have been talking about opening up eventually a training clinic specifically for practicum students to come in and provide services to people at a low fee or no fee at all. And so Carlos and I have been talking about just really, really briefly about some ideas. And I know Laura and I are certainly interested in opening up a very similar clinic in our area.
Fantastic.
It's just really nice to hear that other people are doing the work and thinking about this work, and I find that really exciting. I can sense your excitement too.
You know, and I think that it's really true that there are more people doing this work, and I'm careful not to say like expanding it or beginning to do this work, because it's in the history of psychoanalytic treatment. It's absolutely in the history. It's more returning to this kind of work and having enough of our own subjectivity and our own wisdom to say we don't only need to of course we adhere to the standards that are handed down to us. But a lot of that is convention, and a lot of that is managed by, you know, even external agencies that don't know what we know, right? And so having the wisdom of our own experience and our own practice to bring this richness back to the treatment. There's something I wanted to say about that also. There's a lot. I mean, you're talking about mentorship opportunities, and I hear how this is something that you ask about a lot. And I realize that it's something I don't have a lot of answers to, and probably took some of the direction of my own life because I couldn't find those answers of where do you get support, not only in paid supervision or within an institution that you're also likely paying a lot of money to, but have perhaps even apprenticeship type relationships or mentors in many other fields that have these relationships, not on a paid basis, but as an expectation of we want our future generations to feel like they're a part of us, and we want to share information and resources. Where is that? And I don't have a good answer for you. And so I don't want to go without saying that, and also asking you, maybe because you're in this place of training, and you have this question a lot, like, what do you wish was there that isn't there?
I've been thinking about this a lot, and I don't have a solid answer. I think as I'm associating with this, I just wish there were safe places to go that don't cost a lot of money. I know that's very simple, but it is really hard to find. Mm-hmm. I've certainly looked at consultation groups that unfortunately I can't afford. Mm-hmm. Those seem like great spaces, but I cannot afford those consultation groups. So I guess what I'm thinking about now is just having a space that I can afford, that I can go to for help, to help contribute, to talk. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I'm wishing for. And that's certainly something that Laura and I want to have eventually, once we are licensed and once we're able to provide that for other people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're so right, for so many reasons, that it is about affordability and accessibility. And I think also that we don't need to be such staunch gatekeepers. It reinforces some sense that of like, we know, and you have to pay the price in order to know what we know. So even if financially you can't afford it, there's something that's mistaken about that. And I'm really happy and interested to keep thinking with you about structural ways of changing that.
Looking forward to that. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us today? Anything that came up during our conversation or anything else that you have been thinking about?
There's many, many things I'm thinking about. You know, I think I would just reiterate what I said about believing what people tell you, and in a way that ties back into the subjectivity of the analyst is also believing what you're trying to tell yourself. And if you can have faith in the integrity of what's coming forward in your patient and in yourself, that's the way.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us and joining us today. This was a really delightful conversation that I'm really happy to have had. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to have been here.
Too loud for me, my mind's too loud for me.